and welcome to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Amanda Newell. Amanda Newell is the winner of the 2015 Patricia Dobler Poetry Award from Carlo University's Mad Women in the Attic, judged by Lynn Emanuel. Her recent work appears in Bellevue Literary Review's embattled issue about the ramifications of war, as well as in Pittsburgh Poetry Review. She is the author of the chapbook Fractured Light, winner of the 2010 Dogfish Head Poetry Prize. Amanda Newell is enrolled in the MFA program at Warren Wilson College and teaches high school English on the eastern shore of Maryland at the Gunston School. Hi, Amanda. How are you?
Hi, Jan. I'm well. Thank you so much for having me here today, and it's a delight to be on the program.
Thanks. Congratulations on winning the Dobler Prize as a national award.
Thank you. It's been really exciting and very special to me.
Okay. So you're going to start with the winning poem, is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
A woman from the Infant Mortality Review Board calls. No, I am not an addict. Yes, I had a doctor. No, we are not smokers. No, I do not want you coming to our home. You could see it on the sonogram's chalk sketch, the club foot and cleft palate, fingers like vines, some extra ones. A 1 in 10,000 error of cell division, the specialist said. Most women miscarry before it gets this far. 30 hours after the Pitocin and morphine, after the resident shoved his gloved fist into me to ripen my cervix with a kelp stick, I gave birth to a shiny, bruised doll, small enough to fit into a wicker Easter basket, and whose silence was welcome. I'm going to read a couple of more poems that are in the same vein as that and stem from my own personal experience. Something horribly wrong. Squatting over the toilet bowl, stall flung open, sinks like teeth beneath smeared mirrors, and there are my breasts dripping onto the brown tile. I feel it between my legs, pawing its way out. Slid right through me, rained, while I retched into the kidney dish. Years later, dusting, I pick up the ceramic block, gently shake it. He shifts inside. Jay says he was in the room when Dr. M sectioned me, that, oh, where is my shoe? I cried. Cried again. Child out, child who would not move past my hip bone. Dr. M's hands inside me. Jay, in mask, watching. He gets to hold the baby first, he says. You look like a gutted deer. The bleed. I cannot will it to stop. I might have no more blood. Am I the deer, stomach unzippered and strung from the swing set? My dark sack on the screen, my sons long gone from that surround, what replaces them there? And where is my husband, good man I have not loved well or enough? And is this punishment for that, this loudness of red? This burbling surge. We actually do have deer seasonally strung from the swing set in our backyard during hunting season. It has even been decorated with Christmas lights during the season. So you know, it's like as if a Rudolph has crashed in the backyard there. The next poem is really from an experience watching my son through the kitchen window as he was butchering his sika deer that was hanging from a little maple tree. It's called My Son, 13, Butchers His Sika Deer. Bound by her hind legs, she dangles from the maple. So small, she twirls a little in the breeze. I watch him as he works the knife slowly along the split seam of the cow's belly, peeling away the cotton flaps of her hide like a sock until nothing is left but flesh wrapped in white swirls of gauzy tissue. I did not teach him how to call for his prey on the marsh, how to shoot a living thing, how to butcher it. That was his father. Like his father, he does not mind the blood. He'll take what he needs, nothing more. When he's done, he'll drag what's left of her into the woods. I live on the eastern shore of Maryland, and hunting is very much ingrained in the culture. And we have guns in the household, and that is often something I find myself struggling with, you know, understanding their, my husband and my older son's connection with nature. They eat what they kill. But it's also difficult, I find, at times to reconcile that with the violence of it. And so I find that a lot of my poems tend to, in one way or the other, return to that subject. The next poem I read is a relatively new poem, and it's one that I've actually been trying to write for years now and never really found the way into it. And it's based off of my friend's, the suicide of my very dear friend's daughter, who suffered from bipolar disorder. As those of us who have lost children know, it is not something that you ever get over. And this is something that has stuck with me since then. And it's called this poem that I wrote for Molly, that was my friend's daughter's name. It's called When My Friend Calls, I Go. When my friend calls, I go. I go. Her daughter hanged herself from the cherry tree whose limbs she used to swing as a child. Now she is swinging again, so hard to look. Look at the feet instead. Cracked, muddy heels, tarnished silver, toe ring. She wore the last time I saw her barefoot.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Amanda Newell, reading her poetry. You have a lot of very intense poems, and I wanted to ask you about the challenge of writing about trauma, because, you know, I've certainly seen a lot of poems that try to do that not well, and your poems are so strong. Can you talk about that, what you've run into, what you've learned?
Trauma is actually a subject that I find myself returning to time and again in my writing. And it was really the loss of my first child that turned me to poetry. You know, I'd always been a writer. I actually, growing up in high school, I fell in love with Anne Sexton. She was one of the first poets that that really engaged me. And I can remember listening to her read Ringing the Bells and the sort of deep rasp of her voice. And it was just, it was so powerful. And I think for a long time, I was actually afraid of poetry, as a lot of people, I think, are. But again, it was after the loss of my first child that I turned back to poetry as a way of exploring that trauma. And so what I find coming up in my work time and again is that, you know, if it's not emotional trauma, it's body trauma. As is the case with a series of poems about a former student who enlisted in the Marines and then was deployed to Afghanistan, and after just a couple of months there was blown up by an improvised explosive device. And he survived, was not expected to, and he lost part of his leg, his left leg below the knee. And so I think that the pain of that and having watched the entire process and remembering how excited he was to enlist, it's something he really wanted to do and to serve the country, and then to have it end the way that it did, and have him injured so terribly, was, I think, hard for us, a lot for many of us at the Gunston School in the community. We're a small community there, mm-hmm. where I teach.
Well, I noticed that, I mean, one thing that I notice about your work is the precision of language that seems to support, you know, a very clear look at whatever is happening. And I wonder if that's something that you sort of focus on as a way to ground the poem or to convey some of the difficult material.
I think that's a very good way of putting it. And when I sit down to write something, I play this little game sometimes with myself and will say, okay, you need to write this as if your life depends on it. And I think that...
That doesn't sound like a game. That sounds very real.
Yeah, it is.
With what you're talking about.
When it comes to the revision process, that then is when I have to often remind myself, this is just a poem. It's mm-hmm. not the end of the world.
Right, right. Okay.
If that makes any sense.
Yeah, okay.
But I do think that looking directly at something and not and confronting it is something that I try to do in poetry and what I think I have often a difficult time doing in real life.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay. I just think it takes a lot of courage and a lot of craft to do what you're doing. So
could you
read some more poems?
Sure. I'll read from my series of Adam poems. This poem, it's called Recommendation, and this is one that recently appeared in the Bellevue Literary Review, who dedicated an entire issue to the theme of war and the ramifications of war. And the impulse for this poem was really thinking about what it meant to have written a recommendation, you know, because as teachers, you know, Jan, that we were frequently asked and called upon to write recommendations, and certainly you want to encourage your students to pursue what they want to pursue. And this incorporates language from the headmaster's email that initially told us what had happened. I'll read it. Recommendation. Dear all, the headmaster emails, one of our graduates was seriously injured by an IED while driving a military vehicle in Afghanistan. I push back from my desk. Adam had been my student his senior year. Fractures, concussions, other injuries. Maybe it's not so bad. But then I think we await news on his condition means he could already be dead. Adam once told me he'd walked 100 miles to Ocean City with just water and a protein bar. That he'd slept in ditches to be like those guys who survive for weeks on an MRE. Though we read Hemingway and Crane, Adam wanted to see the crimson clash of war. So I wrote a letter recommending him, without reservation. Lucky. This was written after I had visited Adam with another colleague at the McGuire VA Medical Center in Richmond, and I think that the day that we left, or the day after, there was actually a murder right in the parking lot of the VA center. Adam again finding himself near danger. Lucky. No one could believe it. An Army veteran shot and killed in the parking lot outside Adam's hospital room in Richmond. But he hadn't heard a thing. He'd watched it on TV as news reporters reported live from the scene at McGuire VA Medical Center. Later, when police caught the killer, the custodian who had known his victim, who was his neighbor and a cancer patient, they found 3 spent cartridges and 2 live rounds in the .38 recovered from his blue Ford Explorer. Luckily, they said, it was an isolated incident, not an act of terror, not the kind of act that had nearly killed Adam last year when a man, woman, or God forbid, child had crouched in a ditch, waiting for the front wheels of the MATV Adam was driving to sink a little into the soft pocket of sandy earth before he detonated the bomb he'd planted. It was not the kind of act one could anticipate, even if one were lucky. Jan, we were talking about stick shifts this morning and enjoying driving stick shifts. And I remember visiting Adam at Walter Reed once, and he had just bought a new bright yellow Ford Focus stick shift that he insisted on in spite of the fact of his amputation. And so we got to drive around a little bit in it. Adam drives his Focus around Walter Reed. Adam wanted to show me his new car, a yellow-orange turbocharged hatchback with black leather bucket seats, 19-inch rims, and a stick shift. In America Garage, where most of the wounded warriors keep their cars, red Mustangs and Camaros, lifted matte black pickups with tinted windows. I watched as Adam unscrewed his walking leg, set it by his car, then attached his driving leg to his left stump. Not ready for the highway, he drove us along the perimeter of Walter Reed, past the ER, where, 2 years ago, he'd been taken, barely alive, from Andrews Air Force Base after a transatlantic flight from Landstuhl. We passed the new Navex in Building 10, grazing fawns and amputee patrolmen on segways. Sometimes he stalled, and we'd lurch ahead as he over-revved the engine. And when we passed a legless vet lying on his stomach in the sun, his torso strapped like luggage to his stretcher while his thumbs tapped across the cell phone screen, I thought, it could be worse. And it was for most. But Adam was lucky, because here he was, driving a car whose color Ford called Tangerine Scream, a color I'd call ugly if it wasn't his, if he hadn't said he liked it because you couldn't miss him.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Amanda Newell, reading her poetry. Amanda, when you write poems having to do with, with someone else's experience, and you are in sort of a witnessing or reporting role as a writer, can you talk about any kind of concerns regarding sort of taking advantage of someone else's situation, or even if there's compassion involved? You know what I'm saying? Like, what is the role of the reporter as in you, the writer, in that situation?
I think that's a really good question. It's one that I very frequently struggle with and have struggled with in composing these Adam poems. And I think in this case, one thing that I felt was important to do was let the family know what I was doing. And so I shared much of my work with them. And I really, for me, I think it does have to do with compassion and connecting on a human level, and also recognizing that, you know, there's a ripple effect that, you know, this tragedy was Adam's, and it's something that he continues to deal with. At the end of the day, I can walk away from it. We all can. Adam still has to live with it. But I think it's also important to really explore the impact of something like this on the wider community, because it's not just limited to Adam and his family. You know, I mean, where is Adam going to be in 10 years, 15 years, 20 years? Where are many of our veterans that have been wounded seriously going to be? You know, so I think it's important to witness and not to forget. And I think that there's an element, too, of exploring, particularly with that poem recommendation, our own and my own sense of guilt for having somehow been a part of this.
Right. And it seems that in writing the poems that now, in a way, the reader is implicated and becomes another witness to what has happened, and hopefully, you know, one may think about, you know, what are the implications? What is my part in this? Is there a part in this, et cetera? I don't know if that was part of what you were aiming for or not.
I think so. And I frequently, when I'm talking about this with my high school classes, one of the images and things that I remember about visiting Walter Reed in D.C., actually now it's in, you know, moved to Bethesda, is you can just drive right down Rockville Pike, and, you know, people on their way to and from work into D.C., life going on as usual, normal, everything normal. But then as soon as you get on to Walter Reed, the grounds of Walter Reed military base, it's suddenly very different, and that discrepancy, that dissonance is incredibly hard. You know, you walk around base and everybody's missing something, missing a limb. It's an incredible amount of trauma, and yet, you know, there's just, you know, sort of the other world on the other side. So I think that dissonance was also something that I felt was important to convey or confront.
Right, right. Okay. Could you read some more poems?
Sure. Looking for Adam at McGuire VA Hospital. The hallways smelled of mashed potatoes and canned peas, like lunches you got in grade school with a palm-sized disc of rubbery meat. Here, there was no sound of sneakers on black and white flecked tile. Only the meds robot whizzing by, steel arms outstretched, on its way somewhere to someone's room. Through cracked doors, slivers of white sheets against metal rails, machines huffing like Darth Vader, empty chairs, faint scent of fresh bleach and urine. The visitor's lounge empty, too, except for a few vets in wheelchairs watching Dirty Harry. No one at the nurse's station to ask where Adam was, or if I was even in the right place. That's when I heard it, the hoarse, rasping scream, muffled pulse of bass against the steel door at the end of the hall. It was Adam's new favorite band, he said as I walked in. Had I ever heard of Godsmack? portrait of Adam's foot before amputation at Walter Reed, with a line by Walt Whitman. Charred and purple, it curls in a withered parenthesis as though it might crumble onto his white sheets like rain-soaked rotten wood. "It's no longer a foot to me," he says, shrugging. "It's only one limb. The Marines call that a paper cut." I wonder where his foot will go, if it will burn in the furnace with a whole heap of amputated feet. Maybe it will burn alone. Maybe they will give him back the ashes of himself. I'll turn back to one of the earlier poems that I wrote about my son and hunting. This is First Kill. Our son shoots a deer during muzzleloader season, a doe, small enough to fit into the cooler my husband brought with him. When I get home, there was already a picture on the computer screen. Our boy smiling as he kneels over his kill, her blood staining the leaves. Someday, there will be another body spread before him. She too will bleed. This poem is really an elegy for my first child. It was part of a ceremony that I undertook in honor of him. At the burial mound in Leesburg, Virginia. He gives me a prayer tie to take with me, a bundle of tobacco wrapped in red cloth, an offering for the child I have lost. I go alone to the top of the mound, this place where his Tuscarora ancestors were buried near Goose Creek. January's pallid light lies curled beneath the single tree, its roots like hardened seams in the earth's skin. As I fasten my offering to a branch, he comes to present me with his totem, a small bear carved from stone.
It's the poetry of Amanda Newell. Thank you so much for being here. That was great. You've been listening to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Saturday morning at 6:30 for Prosody, 90.5 WESA.